Welcome, everyone. This is Pranila in the middle of our 40-day shoot-free mind cleanse, and tonight we're having our special bonus call with my dear friend Adyashanti, that some of you may already know. But let me first introduce Adyashanti to those of you who don't know him. Adyashanti is a non-dual teacher, and he's been compared to those of the early Zen masters and Advaita Vedanta sages. Adya expresses both the infinite possibilities and the ordinary simplicity of a spiritually realized life. And Adya is the author of a number of books, amongst which are Falling into Grace, True Meditation, and The End of Your World. And he is an American-born spiritual teacher devoted to serving the awakening of all beings. And his teachings are an open invitation to stop, inquire, and recognize what is true and liberating at the core of all existence. And Adyashanti's teachings are directed to those who are sincerely called to awaken to their true nature and embody this life-changing realization. And in 1996, Adyashanti was asked by his Zen teacher, Arvis, of 14 years, I believe, to teach. And he's been offering these teachings ever since through offering satsang and weekend intensive silent retreats and also a live internet radio broadcast. So welcome, Adya.
Thank you so much.
It's so nice to have you here. Thank you so much for accepting this invitation for a little chat with you about something that is very alive in my heart, the subject of self-love and the importance of that in our awakening and specifically our embodiment process, if there is such a thing. At least it's important for me. I don't know how important it is for other people, but I have been curious to address this and hear how you see it specifically through your lens. And I just want to mention to everybody that the first time I met you, Adya, was actually in 1999 at a satsang event in Los Angeles. And I still remember that when I was sitting there, I felt suddenly this pressure inside of my chest. I felt this immense love in my chest, as if something wanted to burst out. But what I experienced at the same time, that there was some feeling of restriction, almost like an armor or a tight band around my chest, and somehow trying to hold it all in or maybe not letting it in. And even though I haven't really thought about it, but it seems that that love that was trying to burst out or in is something, and how I was not allowing it, I mean, to the best of my ability, that seems to have been with me ever since, and something that I really love to work with myself and with other people. So, and this is kind of what I would like to address a little bit with you today. And, you know, when I was reading through the things that I was writing down from your website about introducing you, you did mention the word embodiment again. And that reminded me of the old days many years ago, when you started teaching, that we had these monthly Sunday intensives. Do you remember those? They were called, I think, embodiment satsang.
Oh, I sure do, yeah.
No, that was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it really resonated with me. You know, you talked about some people wake up from A to Z, and then it was almost like you have to go back and catch up on the whole alphabet. I don't know if you'd use that expression, but that's how I heard it.
Sure.
We couldn't really leave anything behind. So when I saw the word embodiment again, I would love to hear you speak a little bit about what that actually means to you.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on your program with you, first, Pernille. It's nice to be able to talk with you in this way again. But, you know, embodiment really means, it means a lot of different things for a lot of different people. In the general sense, the way I use the term is in terms of spiritual awakening, which is in a sense a fundamental shift, you know, in the ground of our being, where we recognize, I guess you could just say, the truth of our being. And however that happens for somebody, and whatever their sort of own experience of that is, what unfolds after that is usually a process, because as you know, moments of insight or awakening can be very, very instantaneous. It can happen in a snap of a finger. And yet to have what we experience and realize during those moments of incredible clarity kind of has this trickle-down effect through our whole body and mind. And I think of embodiment is, in a generalized sense, of getting all of you on board, you know, in some sort of alignment or harmony with what's been realized. And beyond that, you know, people have their own sort of very unique journey of that. So it can only be generalized, you know, to a certain extent. And then from that point, people have a very unique journey because people have very unique pasts. Their past is unique. Their, you know, their whole upbringing is quite unique. They're right down to their, you know, physical characteristics are unique. So I think the process of the embodiment is also quite unique to each person.
Right. Could you speak a little bit about how the embodiment was for you, if you even remember? Or is it even an ongoing thing?
Well, not in the way that I usually talk about it. It's not. You know, it was a different thing at different phases. Do you know? At one phase, I think at an early phase, after a really sort of powerful spiritual shift, I think a big part of it for me was just sort of getting myself, just in general, on every level, sort of aligned with what I realized. And that actually meant that initially something very simple to me, but simple but not necessarily easy to carry out. And that I think when we have a real deep realization of what I would call absolute truth, the fundamental truth of existence, it also gives us a much greater capacity to have what I would think of as more relative truths, you know? And a relative truth doesn't mean in any way to diminish it. It's still a truth, but it's a relative truth. And so when I started to have the capacity to see all these relative truths. In other words, the ways that I was moving through the world or relating in my everyday life that weren't completely expressions of truth. You know, I think a lot of us, certainly at that point for me, you know, if someone asked me, were you living a sort of a truthful, honest, sincere life, I would say, sure, I was, because I really felt that I was. But the more that gets revealed to us, you know, the more we see those subtle levels of sort of holdouts. So holdouts where I wasn't really living completely what I had realized or completely being true because of various things, you know, fear, conditioning, you know, there were sort of different influences. So that was sort of the initial hurdle of embodiment for me. And I would think that took me probably a good, you know, 4 or 5 years, actually, to really start to get a real clear handle on what it was to sort of live from truth and express that in all through all areas of my life, whether that was through relationships, through work, through daily interactions, through just being, you know, in my own, with myself, in my own company, all of that. So that was the very first part for me. I think the thing that's a little bit different for me that I've noticed for a lot of people is there was some sort of what I would say sort of working out things, unresolved emotional content that also came to the fore during that time. I didn't have a lot. It wasn't something that was really predominant for me, but there was certain things that on the sort of the emotional content level that I had to kind of work through and see the truth in those realms as well. But I would say for the average person, the vast majority of people, when they have some deeper realization, the more conscious they become, anything that we're sort of hiding from, anything that we're avoiding or just misunderstanding, or like you said, anyway, it can be a sort of hiding from a full acceptance of yourself, your humanness. But all those kinds of ways that we might emotionally hide, emotionally barricade, or just simply be in a state of misunderstanding, trauma is really common for people to experience from their past. Things like that kind of get washed up to the conscious level, and I see embodiment as a way of really coming to, coming to accept that, coming to recognize, what is coming into our conscious level, and having the wherewithal to deal with it, instead of just trying to avoid it or transcend it. Mm-hmm. That's why I kind of like the word embodiment, because it's a sort of non-transcendent sort of word to use, And in our culture in the West, and I think this is from all my travels, this is fairly predominant, but especially in the Western culture, what I have found work teaching for all these years now is that over 98% of people in the West have some deep-seated sort of sense of unworthiness. Yeah. And even with spiritual awakening, that sense of unworthiness doesn't necessarily get completely uprooted. And if it's not sort of, embraced and uprooted and taken a look at and really gone into, it can still sort of drive your life without you even knowing it.
I could not agree more, and I actually really love that you use that word unworthiness, because I've seen that in myself and in my clients and in friends and basically almost everybody.
Epidemic.
And it's just so strange when you really see that, and when you start moving out of it, it really doesn't make sense, but it's almost like there is some kind of a veil that we are under. And I just want to bring it back to, the 40-day shoot-free mind cleanse that we're on, where last year I saw, I was in a situation, and suddenly I just saw this veil of should that it kind of colored everything. And, I have a very beautiful life. I was not like totally in the gutters at all, but I could just see that it was coloring everything, and there was an underlying should. And I think what a lot of people are starting to realize already on this little class that we're doing is to see that the underlying thing is basically that we should be different than we are. And it's such a deep pattern that keeps us separate and separate and separate, because we can never fully embody who we are if we think that who we are is wrong or should be different. And I remember also in the early days, I don't know if you still use that term, but you talked about that love comes back for all of itself. And do you remember you used that term?
I do. Yeah, I still use it occasionally, sure.
Yeah, that was another one that just like, yes, my whole body said yes. And that's why somehow this self-love is a big part of what I seem to bring into my life. And you know, it's not that self-love is the goal, because we already are it, but it is helpful to break down the parts where we do not love ourselves so we can actually start experiencing the oneness. So has that, this self-love, is that something that you have, that has helped you to integrate the parts that you started seeing in those 4 years?
It's a great question, Pranella. And in fact, this is something that I kind of knew for a long time, but I just started reflecting on it probably in the last couple of years. And that's why I said some parts of my journey are kind of a little bit atypical. And I say that because I don't, there were certain moments, you know, of life, during life, of feeling, you know, whatever it was, you know, feeling ashamed or not worthy or disappointed in myself or, you know, those kind of things. But they were very, very situational. And I didn't sort of grow up with a sense of a lack of self-worth. For me, it was sort of self-worth, sort of positive and negative, was sort of a non-issue for me. And, you know, a lot of that has to go with, you know, just the family I was in and, you know, what was reinforced with me. And probably some of it was, you know, I just kind of came in to this incarnation with, you know, it's always hard to say. But having said that, you know, my observation is probably, you know, maybe 90% or more, 98% or people more, that it's a very significant issue for them. Do you know? I mean, we all have our own issues. That wasn't a sort of a big underlying theme for me personally, to be really honest. But you know, that doesn't mean that there weren't, you know, working through some layers of you know, different kinds of identification and trying to be somebody. And you know what I mean? And especially in spirituality in the early days, you know, trying to be sort of perfect and come up all these ideals and, you know, of course, failing at doing all of that, which I think most of us generally do. And that didn't feel very good. But I really, in different ways, I really did see that, you know, even though I didn't walk around with sort of, I think, what I would think of as a sort of a deficient sense of self, I did find it, you know, absolute necessity at a certain point in my journey to really come to a really deep and full acceptance of my humanity and everything that meant. You know, that's the best and the worst of it, and the strength of it, and the frailty of our human nature, and the fallibility of it, and you know, all those qualities of what it's like just to have the human experience, to come to a real acceptance of them, and not just an acceptance like a begrudging acceptance, but a real love, a real appreciation for that aspect of our nature. You know, that's also an aspect of divinity. From what I've seen, I often tell people, you know, the last thing and the biggest thing in the whole universe you'll ever come to fully accept is your own humanity. You know, you'll probably accept everybody else in the whole world and the whole universe before you accept your own humanity completely and absolutely. And so however it comes to us, for whatever reason, I think it's really essential to happiness, to a sense of well-being, and also just perceiving truth, perceiving things the way they really are. You know, otherwise we're always sort of looking through that lens of the language you use, which I like. You know, we can look through our whole life through the lens of should and shouldn't. And yet, at any moment, we are just what we are at any moment, you know. But letting go of the should and shouldn't is kind of like losing a piece of our worldview, you know. It's a nice one to lose,
yeah.
But it can be pretty significant.
Yeah. I mean, for me, since I saw, since I saw that last year, I really went on a 40-day where I said, you know, no more. And whenever shoot came up that was conscious, because most of them are unconscious, I was just determined. And what is left when we don't go by the shoulds is really what does my heart want? What is really true here? And start trusting that. And that in itself has been an amazing journey. And I just feel it has softened me into who I am, whatever that means. You know, there's so much less edginess and but I had to be very, very firm for a long time and say no, because we're being bombarded everywhere, and it's so unconscious. It's like it's prevalent in a whole of society, you know, in all the ads and everything. We are basically being told we should be different than we are. And I see that there's so much suffering in that. And it's, I don't know, it just almost feels like it's just being bombarded at us to keep us separate.
Yeah, it's absolutely is the predominant cultural message we receive from the time we're born until the time we die. Is we should be some other way. And even more than that, if we should be some other way than the way we are, and if we can ever become that, then we'll be happy. You know, that happiness is almost never tied to, you know, what we are right here and right now. It's usually tied to what could be, or even worse than that, what should be. Yeah, and I can absolutely understand that necessity of, first of all, really becoming conscious of how damaging the whole should message is. And I think that's really important, that it's because it can be almost like an addiction, you know, and it's important to sort of be able to step back and see how damaging it is to oneself, to others, to the world, you know, to let that should message run our whole lives. And I think, like you did, when you really start to see how hurtful it is, how much pain it causes, then at some point you either feel bad about that, or some little switch clicks in you and you see, no, that's, I'm not going to keep giving my life to that. You know, my life is about something other than who I should be. And that's a big, you know, it sounds kind of like a simple thing when we talk about it, doesn't it? But, you know, you've seen it. I've certainly seen it in all my years of teaching, that it's a very, 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 it's a very big step. It really is it's a big step, because in my teaching, you know, I see that people can have these very sort of transcendent experiences. They can sort of wake up from, you know, their whole notion of self, but that in and of itself rarely actually frees them from the shoulds and the shouldn'ts and, you know, all those ways that that we've been sort of culturally indoctrinated into, you know, diminishing ourselves and diminishing others as well.
Yeah. You know, and I also think when it's not seen, because I have been around a lot of people who've had, you know, big awakenings, or at least claim to have them. But when you look at their lives, they don't feel wholesome or even happy. It just feels like there's just a split inside many times. And I guess it is by grace when we see that split, and when we see how we are separating ourselves from who we are and then denying it because we've had this amazing awakening experience. And I think it can be very confusing if these people are teachers or, you know, take on a certain role. That can be very, very confusing for people who have not had that experience and then believe that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, it's not the truth. And I just think it is so essential to bring it all into the oneness and love, because to me, love is the number one. For other people, it may be, who knows what. I can only speak for myself.
Yeah, they might have
a
different way of explaining it, but sure. Sure, I agree that this is, you know, it's one of the dangers of a big spiritual shift is that you do tend to often part of it is that very transcendent element, and for a while that feels extraordinarily free and liberating, and it feels like, you know, your whole sort of human self or has sort of just been so transcended that it's almost not even there, you know. But then, but that's a relatively temporary state, and then certain elements will come back, and you're entirely correct. It's very, very often, in most of the time, in most cases, there will be either an unconscious or sometimes an unconscious effort made to sort of deny the human part. And I think one of the reasons that this comes about is, I mean, number one, I think it comes about just because, you know, it takes a lot for someone to come to sort of that kind of humility where they're willing to see all parts of themselves. You know, it's humbling, but a beautiful kind of humbling. Again, I think we tend to confuse feeling humbled with being humiliated, which are two very different things. And our humanness can humble us in a beautiful way if we're not judging it or we're not saying it shouldn't be a particular way. But I think one of the real big misunderstandings is when one talks of something like, you know, the absolute truth or the deeper nature of our being or whatever, is it's easy to forget that there is sort of an absolute final sort of truth of existence, let's say, experience. But that doesn't therefore mean that all the other sort of dimensions of experience suddenly become untrue and unreal. I think that's a faulty conclusion. One could make that conclusion, but I don't think it's actually an accurate conclusion. There are many levels of and dimensions of what it is to be, to exist. And each of those sort of dimensions, each of those levels of experience have their own truths. And while you can transcend some of those levels, it doesn't mean you've come to harmony on them. It doesn't mean that particular level, that the beauty and the love and the truth of that sort of liberating insight has penetrated into that level. You may have just transcended beyond it. But since we are all the whole, since oneness has to, by its very nature, mean one, you know, nothing then is left out. Nothing is ultimately left behind. And we have to come to a reckoning of the truth and the reality of these different sort of dimensions of our being, these different different ways that existence shows up, you know, from something that's extraordinarily humbling and human to something that's very exalted and almost beyond imagination.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, I got a little curious about you said, I can't remember the words, like there is some kind of an ultimate, I don't know what words you used there, and then there's all the other levels. And, you know, it's so beautiful because, of course, it's all of it. And mm-hmm. when you start in kindergarten, you still need to go through all the other grades before you graduate. So, mm-hmm. and they're all necessary for whatever reason. I don't know if there is an ultimate reason for being here. I think we find that inside of ourselves what experience might be something that wants to experience itself as, whether it's love or the big nothingness or the big oneness or just compassion. I mean, there can be so many impulses that are all true and real and that cannot be denied just in order to experience the ultimate, because why are we here?
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, in my experience, that I'll just use the word the infinite. The infinite seems to have just a, I don't know another word except desire, even though that's not really the right word, but it seems to have a desire to experience itself in all realms of experience, in all realms of being, you know, in all ways. And it's just our minds, and that think that no, there's only one way that it wants it to experience itself, and it looks like this, you know, and it doesn't. Sometimes it's like sort of razor clarity of truth. Sometimes it's the infinite love that wants to be experienced and expressed, that the infinite wants to experience itself as that love. Sometimes it wants to experience itself as the unity, to see itself in everything. Sometimes it wants to experience itself through one individual incarnation and to experience itself through that unique lens, which there is no two just alike. All of those and much more, are to me all different various ways that the infinite experiences itself. And it's just usually some sort of fear or should or shouldn't or effort to escape or something where our minds would try to deny some part of the truth of our being, the really all inclusiveness that it really is. And
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to end up and to tie in with what you're all looking at, and one of the primary and most powerful ways that our minds keep us from experiencing the full dimension of our being is through shoulds and shouldn'ts. That's one of the most powerful ways that it limits us.
The big limiter should.
Yeah, and I think there's also that sort of fear, is there not? That, without the who I should be or who I shouldn't be, or if we put it the other way, who they should be, who they shouldn't be, without that, there's something in the mind that temporarily can feel kind of lost. Where do I stand then? It likes that sort of familiar reference point, And without the should and without the shouldn't, whether that's turned within oneself or projected out towards others, it's like the mind kind of goes through that place of feeling like it's kind of lost its equilibrium for a while. It's looking for a new way to be. And I think just the uncomfortability or the unknownness of letting go of that reference point of shoulds and shouldn'ts is something that that itself can keep people from, really, really letting go. Because we're so used to having a reference point. It's almost like culture says, you have to know exactly, what you're for, what should be, and you have to know what shouldn't be, and you have to be very clear on these, and have to have these very well-formed opinions on the whole matter. And that keeps us locked in until we see, maybe all that's not true. Maybe all that's just a misunderstanding, actually. Maybe it's time to look at life and look at self from a different point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, it is so interesting to see that it's one way to break out of the false identity and start realizing how we are much more or less than that, call it whatever you will. And then it's almost like the next step is then to break out of the societal trance that we still live under. Maybe no matter how awake we may be in the beginning or later on, there's still a societal trance that we all buy into. And if we step out of it, it's kind of like it wants to push us back in there because we can't just stand out and be different. And, you actually mentioned one of my now favorite words, desire, because last year in a meditation, suddenly I kind of was shown what it meant. I didn't know, I hadn't asked for it, but the word is like de and sire. And I looked up sire, and I saw in a meditation what it meant. It's basically of God or of the creator or of the originator. And I saw that was the purest sense of desire. And when we suppress that desire, that deep desire in our heart, it comes out, twisted and thwarted outside, and then we start kind of desiring things that don't really matter, and that's because we get into that should thing. But so when I started letting go of the shoulds, it's like, well, what do I do then, right? And then there was an invitation to go into my heart and really start trusting that and standing fully in my own authority. And, you know, Adia, that can be very scary because you're on your own, and I know you probably know a lot about that, but that can be mighty scary, and it can be easy to go back to the old, the shoulds, and then do what everybody else does, but not being happy and not being free.
Sure, well, that's a part of, I think, most people that, you know, either consciously or unconsciously, they want to fit in, you know, they don't want to be singled out, they don't want to be, you know, seen as different, and yet, you know, we can't really discover that true and authentic autonomy without letting go, starting to let go of some of that, to see through it, to see that, you know, if we just look all around us in life and even in the natural world, you know, there aren't like forests filled with pine trees that are all trying to be just the right pine tree. You know, fortunately, they don't have these human characteristics. They're just being what they are. They're fully revealing and just being what they are. And yeah, it's a fear. And what I find when I work with people, there's also, I call it a collective, one of the collective taboos. There's a number of collective taboos that are kind of out going at the collective level of consciousness. And one of the collective taboos is, you know, the taboo against really finding and standing in your own true autonomy. And it's almost like, you know, there's something in us that wants it, that desires it, that feels a pull that way, and there's simultaneously this, it can be a personal taboo, but there's also a taboo in the collective that says, no, don't get too far out there. Don't get too, you know, don't be too much yourself. That kind of keeps things constrained, you know. And I see people, they encounter both levels of that, the personal and the collective, that thing that tries to keep us in check, I guess you might say, in an unhealthy way, you know, in a way that doesn't really serve anything but suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you've probably heard me say, I don't know, but to me, one of the things I think that speaks to people about some of the great religious figures, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or, you know, there's many others, not only is it their realization or their compassion or their wisdom or those particular qualities, but I think there's something that speaks to people in a really, in an unconscious way, where if you notice, they were all very, they all had a real deep spiritual autonomy. They weren't trying to be like somebody else. And they really just, you know, without creating new barriers and new islands to stand upon, they were just completely, you know, willing to stand up in their own autonomy. And I think that's part of what really resonates for people about some of the, you know, great spiritual figures throughout history is their spiritual autonomy, which is a very powerful thing. You know, it's a very, very powerful thing.
Can you say more about what is powerful about it?
Well, I think there's different ways of looking at that. I mean, and I guess from it's powerful more from a human sense, in that it tends to release a great amount of energy and creativity, and of course love and compassion. It releases that into your system when you can really step into your true spiritual autonomy, you know. Because what we don't know until that time is the failure to do so chews up vast amounts of inner energy, whether it's raw physical energy or it's subtle energy or it's emotional energy, intellectual energy. Huge amounts of energy go into maintaining these boundaries that we erect upon and around and within ourselves. And we only know how much energy they chewed up in when they're no longer there. And all of a sudden, there's this opening of tremendous energy, of tremendous well-being, of tremendous creativity, and also a tremendous, I would think of it as an authentic fearlessness. Do you know? It's because when we really step there, we really are kind of stepping beyond fear, beyond all fear.
You know, I'm sitting here with a big smile on my face as you say that, because that has so been my experience. It was almost like this inspiration and aliveness is being freed up consistently as I just keep stepping more and more into my own authority or into my own truth or flow, whatever we call it. And even though it's a little scary sometimes, it's also really exciting.
Yeah.
It's like there's something like, wow, what else is possible? You know, once you take the step, it really is true that that's when the next stone or whatever appears, you know, to step on. But
mm-hmm.
you don't know until you actually take that step. But by taking that step into yourself, you create the path to walk on, and we don't know what it is. And I think that is scary in the beginning, and to get used to the fact that we actually don't know what we're stepping into. But every time we do, it feels very alive and powerful in a non-ego way. It's like being in full alignment with who we are somehow. I don't know how to put words to it.
I think that's a wonderful way to put words to it.
Yeah.
Alignment,
yeah, that's
full
my
alignment with who we are.
Full alignment. Did you usually I kind of put my hands in front of me like they're right aligned, you know? That's what it feels like. It's like click, 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 boom. This is now I'm me in this expression. And I don't know if there is anything more delicious than that. There might be, but it feels pretty darn good. And, you know, I do
think,
it does. And I do think, Adia, that these days I have been involved in many, many different arenas, learning a lot of ways to, you know, to market myself and to get in touch with my message. It seems that that's like the current new thing where people really want to find that inside of themselves. Not quite knowing what it is, but there is something stirring inside so many people looking for something that feels like a purpose. And I remember in the beginning, in the earlier years, you know, when people talked about purpose, I think you may have been one of those who said there really is no purpose. And I know that at a certain level to be true. But at this level, at least where I'm at, to click into that, what feels like a purpose, is really where I will feel some kind of fulfillment of being here. And if I keep living in the should realm, I will not find that. But there is a deep movement in so many people to find that true purpose. And specifically because the world is in such a state these days that we all feel like, you know, this is not right. It can be different, and we feel it in our hearts, and we want to do something, but we don't quite know how, right? We need to step out of the old and into something we don't know yet. But I think many people know inside their hearts that there is some other purpose than what they're doing right now. Do you have anything to say about that?
Sure. I think, you know, I think what people have, we can do different language for it. Purpose is perfectly fine. I think what people really, really are yearning for, you know, is to come into that total alignment with all dimensions of their being. So they sort of all line up, you know, They're all saying yes. They're all going in the same direction. And that experience itself is, you know, an experience of great well-being, great happiness. And it also often gives a direction, you know, in a given moment or a given year or whatever it is. It lines up, and all of a sudden a particular direction becomes clear, a direction that, like you said, is often it's like a way to move in the unknown. You know, it's not that it gives us guarantees, but it sort of casts us into the unknown, but in a way that we feel very aligned and very, you know, I think when we're casting about for our purpose and our meaning, that a lot of that is we're looking for ourselves. You know, we're looking to find ourselves. We're looking to find that. We're looking to find our authenticity, and we're also looking to find sort of that experience where everything lines up. You know, all those dimensions of being line up, and we sort of have a yes on all those levels rather than yes on some and no on others. You know. And it is until you get really used to it. It has that uncomfortable quality because you really are cast into the unknown, because there aren't sort of, you know, guarantees that you are often aren't given, you know, precognition of how something's always going to work out. So it is, you know, a little bit like, you know, going by intuition, but at the same time it's very enlivening, very enriching, and over time, you know, you've just come to trust it so much, and the alignment gets so deep. You know, at a certain point, the alignment gets so deep, you don't even really have to trust it, because that's just what there is. And I think my sense is that's what a lot of people are, you know, looking for without even really knowing it. That is also, however, something that for most people it doesn't have to be hard won, but there's usually an element of hard won. You know, we really have to look at ourselves. We really have to look inside. We really have to be honest, but be honest without the judgment and the shoulds and the shouldn'ts and all of that, because that's not a part of honesty. That's just our conditioning. We really have to be willing to dig down in there and find within one's being what's truly and really authentic. And then, you know, like you said, and like you were saying, that you've been doing yourself is when you really see, and you just look at, okay, what are those things that are holding me back? What is the shoulds and the shouldn'ts that I'm holding me back? And you just sort, you're deciding that, you know, that your life isn't going to be run by them indefinitely. And I think one of the things that comes surprising to people, you know, is when they realize that there is no force out there that's telling you what you can and can't do. All the limitation is self-imposed. It's all self-imposed. And we, in some way, I think most human beings, they get this sort of feeling like, well, other people can, but I can't. Or I have to have permission. I have to have someone tell me, you know, it's okay if, you know, and then from another perspective, when you see it, you realize, my God, there never was any of those limitations. They weren't floating out there in the universe. You know, if anything, the universe was waiting for you to get on board, you know. rather than, you know, waiting for you to get it all right or get the requisite permission, it's like the universe is saying, what are you asking for? Just come on.
Yeah.
Step forward. And I think that it's like a really unconscious thing, but I think a lot, it kind of ties it back in with the should and shouldn't in a certain way, whereas I think a lot of people, there's this unconscious way where we kind of feel like we need, you know, permission to be who we are.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes that's nice when you can get that affirmation and that kind of permission. That can be really nice, but also at a certain point, you know, the time comes when we have to really stand up on our own two feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that permission you're talking about, I think it's something we do need for a while because we're stepping out of an old way of being. But those people who are doing it and who have stepped into their own authority, they actually give the permission by living it. And you know, I can give the permission verbally, but it has to be done in a way so it starts resonating in people so they can feel that it is actually true and not just some silly words.
Yeah,
but
they have to find it.
And sometimes we need to spark it in them so they can actually know what it means, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But when that happens, Adia, because what's my experience for a while is like the being and doing, it's one thing.
Yeah.
Right? There's not me doing anything. They come together. It's one thing. And when that started being seen, it's like, oh, but it's so simple.
Yeah.
But it wasn't simple to get there.
No, that's the hard one part.
Yeah, but
it is extraordinarily simple. Yeah, exactly. When the being is an expression of the being, and the being is an expression of the doing, it's all sort of very. It's very simple, but it's not something we can ever come up with in our minds, is it?
Yeah.
We have to be able to sort of let go and listen inside to a quieter voice. And then it starts to become much more simple.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thank you. I'm really sitting here with a big smile. I just love everything you're saying. And, of course, it's because it resonates. Otherwise, I might not be smiling. Or maybe I would.
No, I don't imagine.
But It just feels enlivening, you know. There's like this expansive feeling when there's a feeling of yes in me, and it's like, yeah. That's kind of one of my guides, to just let that expansive feeling guide me. But, you know, I'm noticing we're coming close to the hour, and I would love to see if there's some questions. But before I ask for questions, if you guys who are on the phone, if you have a question, you know, please press star 2, and then I will unmute you in a moment. But before I do that, Adia, is there any last thing that you would like to share with people that seems relevant to what we've been talking about?
Nothing I can think of. I think we've talked about plenty. Boy, I have no message I want to leave anybody with. I'd rather leave them with themselves and with listening to themselves than holding on to a message that I might give them.
Okay. Yeah, but that might be exactly what
that
you
might
need
be the message
hear,
right there.
What you said there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So would you be ready for a few questions?
Of course.
Okay, so there's one. If you're on the webcast, you can type in your question and send it. And if you're on the, the phone, press star 2. Let me just take, there's a question here on the webcast. Let me read that to you. When I started working on these things, I was filled with anger. And much of that was directed at God, because I was actually shooting God, thinking that God should be different from what I was seeing in the world. For example, how could God allow all the horrors in this world? Thankfully, I'm past that now, and I have a felt sense that everything is as it's meant to be, and a felt sense of loving presence. So my question is, did your concepts of God change in your journey to awakening? And if so, how did these viewpoints change? And these questions are for both of us, it looks like. But why don't you...
Little question, isn't it? Great question. Well, of course, my concepts of God, they not only got changed, they basically just got completely blown out of the water. you know, they just got completely reorganized because, you know, even if we don't come from, I didn't come from like a really religious family in the sense of going to church or somewhere every weekend or temple. But we, nonetheless, you know, we grow up with this sort of image of God as like some like infinitely large human being with a old gray beard, and you know what I mean? That's sort of directing the movements of life in a way from some, you know, vast far away position. But you know, all that sort of I lost all that. I mean, that's part of, I think, what awakening is. You sort of wake up from not only our notions of ourselves, but also our notions of what divinity is and what God is. You know, and God, we realize that God isn't, you know, if we hold on to this notion of God as sort of this bigger version of a human being, then, you know, then God's really got a lot of explaining to do for himself or herself. You know, there really isn't a way to justify it all so that it doesn't have massive contradictions in it. But when we see from a different, a deeper perspective, you know, then God, I think, is, you know, is, gosh, it's hard, would be hard to say what the notion of God became for me. I would just say, I just would maybe just call it the infinite. But I can't, I no longer separate the infinite or God from anything, whether it's from the smallest fleet or to the greatest supernova in the greatest galaxy to some man or some woman sipping coffee in the morning. You know, I think that God is very much the essence and the very substance of all and everything. You know, I don't necessarily think that God is sort of sitting up there going, well, I'll have these people suffer and these people have a good day. And these, you know, that I think sort of collapses along the way, which is a very good thing. Yeah. But for some people it can be, you know, it can be a big transition, you know, kind of to have this sort of very personalized sense of God. And at some point that sort of changes into a whole different sense of what God is, you know. But I wouldn't want to overly define what that is, because I think it's important that each person, you know, find out what those ideas mean and what their experience of them, and to see how they do transform as you transform, you know, because they certainly do.
Yeah. Sounds beautiful, yeah.
And so what the caller or the person who wrote in wrote, I think, is really, you know, it's, you can't make conceptual sense out of the experience in the sense that everything is sort of unfolding with its perfection, because anybody and everybody could come up with examples why it's not, why it doesn't look that way. But what the person who wrote in is, they're not trying to say it's a new philosophy. It's just they're trying to communicate an experience, and that's a great transformation to go from blaming God for different events in life, and then seeing that there's an inherent underlying beauty or perfection to life, which doesn't discount the difficulty and the sorrow that people go through, but there is an underlying perfection to it. And that's a real transformation of consciousness to be able to say that and really experience that.
Yeah. Did you want to say more about it, or shall I just add my...
Go by all means. Go ahead. Yeah,
yeah,
sorry about that.
No. I wanted you to finish. No, what I think what I want to just add to that is that in my experience, it was because I did have some belief of this God up there, but who was basically out to get me, more or less. But what I realized, you know, over time, that I was actually the one who was out to get me. And when I stopped doing that and stopped resisting being loved, stopped resisting being love, and stopped resisting receiving, you know, my experience of this world changes every time. So the God that I was projecting out there was, you know, my experience probably from some things in my childhood. And once I just let all that go and I could see that I was doing it all to myself, it doesn't even make sense anymore. It's actually irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's just really resting back into the presence, the love, the being that I am. And I don't know, I just don't even, it's not something I think about, but I used to, so I can certainly appreciate the question.
Of course.
And, yeah.
One of my favorite quotes was from an old Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart, who had a prayer to God, please relieve me of a notion of God so I can experience God directly.
Yeah.
And I always really loved what a wonderful prayer that is.
That's so true. Yeah. Great. Well, there's two more questions here on the caller, so I hope that answered your question on the webcast. So let's take, there's a hand up here. Judith, let's see, you should be unmuted now. So Judith, please ask your question.
Hello, Judith. Are you there?
Judith, I have. Well, let me just see.
Hi. Can you hear me?
No?
Okay.
Now I can. It's me and my technical difficulties here.
Okay, great. Go ahead,
dear.
Hi. Well, hello. Thank you very much to both of you. This conversation has been so helpful, especially the unworthiness and the spiritual autonomy. And I'm finding, you know, as I work with this cleanse that we're doing, and I look at my shoulds, I have, you know, really strong feeling just I should not be who I am. But then what I'm finding mixed in there is I should not, this is so crazy, I should not be awake to whatever degree I am awake. And I feel like it got tied in with shame about myself, and there's feelings like, you know, of course there's fear of it, and then there's fear of kind of leaving people, or that I could do something that would harm people from that place. But I feel like all these years I've been working so hard, supposedly, on my spiritual path, and then it feels like at the same time I've been resisting, like that's a should, I should not be that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny how it gets all mixed up like that, isn't it, Judith?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. And if you're not, you know, without even knowing it, sometimes your spiritual path can turn into a should path, you know, a new should path.
Right.
A more spiritual version. And then, like you said, simultaneously, there can be, you know, that sense of almost like, I think you mentioned it a little bit ago in what you just said, of almost like you can't, you know, you can't leave humanity behind. I mean, you can't, you're not supposed to see things different, you know? Like, it's not
right.
Okay. If you were just to let go of the shoulds, you know, then there's something that's like, it's another one of those collective taboos, which
mm-hmm.
is kind of like, it's not okay just to, you know, let go and really see things, you know, quite differently.
Right. And also it feels like, I shouldn't be that big, like there would be a bigness there, and I should just stay small.
Yeah, that's right. That's the voice that the should has, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the thing, though. But you already are that big, aren't you? You already are that big, and you already are that small, both.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so even with you... When you allow yourself to, you know, kind of touch upon that, kind of taste that, then you realize, oh, well, it's a little late for what I should or what I should think I should or shouldn't be, you know?
Yeah.
You already are bigger than you would have ever given yourself permission to be. You already are. It's not like you'll give yourself permission and then be larger.
I see that. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're just allowing yourself to see it, to recognize what's always been the case. But you just, you know, you just were, like most of us, you're just sort of in lots of different ways you know, it was reinforced as a person you should be.
Right.
And yet, you know, you are what you are. And it's as big and it's as small and it's as everything and as nothing as you really are. And it includes all of that.
Hmm.
And to see your shoulds and shouldn'ts, it's not like you just sort of then reject them. You just sort of see them as almost like suffering beings, you know, it's points of confusion and suffering that then can also be embraced.
Mm.
You know, because a should or a shouldn't, it's there's, underneath it, it's almost like a scared child.
Yeah, definitely.
The energy of it.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And what do we do with scared children? I mean, do we look at them and just walk away? Or is our instinct to look at them and kind of go over there and embrace them?
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because even if you reject your shoulds or shouldn'ts, it's different to see that they're not really true than to reject them.
Right.
Right. You just, because when you see, oh, it's just an old program, an old tape, and there's a lot of fear about it, and that's what kept it going, and it's the understanding, and it's the love and compassion that comes for that kind of, you know, sorrow that the should carried with it through a lifespan up until this point.
Mm.
And when it can be embraced in that way, you know, then in that kind of acceptance, that kind of love, then it can kind of reintegrate back into the totality. You know, the shoulds
right.
don't even get kicked out. They just be allowed to kind of come fully home.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that really makes sense because I've been feeling like whatever the awakeness is, it's like really deep in my body and there's this like gateway that I can't get past because it's just so frightening. But as you're saying this, I feel like it's really just the fear of feeling, kind of feeling through the sadness and fear.
Yeah.
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 It's probably what a lot of the fear is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just there to be, you know, and it's there until we're ready to, you know, be, to realize our true capacity and realize that we're big enough to experience and to embrace it all, whether it's the sorrow of the should and the shouldn't or whether it's the fear of the unknown or, you know, some sort of fear of non-existence, whatever the fear is, when we realize that we actually have the capacity to embrace all of that.
Hmm.
So, instead of, you know, running away from it.
Right.
It's the doorway. It's the doorway in, deeper into the truth of yourself. You know?
Mm. Yeah.
Don't we often think that the doorway into to divinity, we have this conditioned idea that it's supposed to be sort of, you know, decorated very nicely with angels and or whatever. You know, it's supposed to be very lovely. And so we keep looking for those doorways. And, you know, sometimes it appears that way, but often the doorways into that deeper divinity and also into deeper humanness are those doorways of the things that we're running away from. That's our doorway.
Oh, yeah, that's so good because often when I hit those places, I feel like, oh, no, something's gone wrong instead of this could be its doorway. So
right. I often tell people when you start to feel afraid, that means you're getting in the right, you're going in the right direction.
Oh, okay.
You start to feel a little, you know, a little like discombobulated, like where do I stand and what, you know, when you get that means you're getting closer to the depth of your true being.
Oh, wow, that's
something
great.
Your mind can't understand, so it just scares itself.
Oh, that's really good to know.
It's important to know that.
Yeah.
It's really important, because otherwise, every time you experience that fear, you'll think, my God, I made a wrong turn.
Right,
something's
exactly.
Gone wrong. I have to find a more beautiful, a different doorway.
Right.
You know? No, it's those are the doorways, you know. It's just like those like cathedrals in Europe where they have those gargoyles around the four corners and often demons guarding the entrance, you know, to the church and stuff or the doorway. And at some point, somebody had a deep understanding of human nature and realized that it's not only, but in part, it's when we really can just face and embrace those demons, those fears, that they're actually actually the doorway inside to the inner chamber, you know.
Mm. Oh, that's wonderful. That's really helpful.
The shoulds and the shouldn'ts are some of the most common demons hanging out around the doorway, you know. Or you don't deserve this, right? You taste beauty of pure being, and the old tape says, oh, you don't deserve this. You look at the kind of person, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And I'll tell you what I did when that came up for me many, many years ago. And different people, the different responses work for them. But what I came up with was when that little voice came in the head, I just thought, you know what? You're right. I don't deserve any of it. Unfortunately, that doesn't count. You know what I mean? How could anybody deserve that? You know, so it's not like we're undeserving in like some terrible way, but it's more like it's a grace. It's given. Deserving isn't part of the equation.
Mm.
You know, you don't have to deserve. That's why it's a grace. You know, you don't have to deserve what you truly already are.
I see.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Your mind might get you to try to believe that, but you really, you know.
Right. That's just that same voice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the old voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. Especially helpful to hear we have the capacity to face it, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm really glad you called in, Judith.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Did we have somebody else, Pernilla?
You know, we had, but that hand went down. So I think we're at the end of our questions, and we're also at the end of our time. So, yeah, Adia, thank you so much. I mean, really, what a treat to spend this time with you and ask all these great questions and get these great answers. So I think everybody will really benefit from this. I certainly am, too. So is there anything you would like to add before we sign off?
I'd just like to add, you know, thank you for having me on and for anybody that's listening. And, you know, I think when Judith called and expressed her experience and what she was expressing, I think that probably everybody that was listening could get a lot out of that, would have their own experience of that, because what she was talking about was really everything we were talking about before. You know, in a very concrete way. And I just feel like her call was just sort of perfectly voiced what, you know, this whole hour was really about. So I was really happy that that it turned out that way, and I hope all the others feel the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Everybody who was on the call, thank you so much. It was really nice to share this with you, and I hope this is helping in our cleanse. We have about, I think, 28 more days until we're going to be squeaky clean, freed from shoulds, or at least knowing how to not ingest them anymore. And I also just want to let everyone know that if you wanted to get a little more familiar or connected with Adi Ashanti's teachings, you can go to his website at adiashanti.org. And I think, is it every week you have a radio show, Adia, or how often is that?
I have them twice a month. And each month is a little different. So if people go on, they can find out when we have them. But I try to have one twice a month. And then sometimes we do courses where I'll do it every week. But generally twice a month. Yeah.
Great. So if anybody would like some more information, they can find all that on your website, I assume, right?
It's all there, and even a whole lot more that I don't even know about. So on there that I can keep track of.
I believe you.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you again, Adia, from the bottom of my heart. And thank you for everybody for being here. And I wish you all a beautiful evening. And I hope this helps you connect deeper into your truth in your heart, and that you find more courage to live your own truth. So thank you, everyone, and have a beautiful evening.
Good night. Good night, Pranella.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye, Anya. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.